Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Education. This is Pengfei Zhao from Bloomington, Indiana. Today, I will be talking with Patricia Levy about her book, Low-Fat Love Stories. The book was co-authored by sociologist and writer Patricia Levy and art therapist and artist Victoria Scotti. It is a collection of short fictions and artistic portraits focusing on women's dissatisfying relationship. What makes these stories really different from a typical fiction is that all these stories are based on interviews with women of different ages and cultural backgrounds. In other words, what I included in this book are real stories taking place every day in our ordinary life. In the book, you will read extremely candid and moving personal stories, emotional and identity struggles, as well as painstaking self-reflection. Low-fat Love Stories is very well received among not only social science researchers, but also general intellectual audience. Today, we are very excited to have the first author of the book, Patricia Levy, to share with us her writing and research experience. I'm with Patricia Levy to talk about her book, Low-Fat Love Stories. Welcome, Patricia.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure to have you here to talk with our audience about your book. And the book was... The book is not a new book, but it was just reprinted, if my memory is correct.
The book came out, I think, about a year and a half ago.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, so it's still pretty new.
Yes.
So maybe we can start with some self-introduction. Would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure. So my name is Patricia Levy, and I'm a sociologist by training. My main areas of expertise are in research methodology and also in interviewing women and studying women's lives. And over the years, those two passions of research methods and studying women's lives intersected because I realized that I needed new approaches and new ways to get at the knowledge that I was interested in and to share it with audiences. And that led me to arts-based research, which I think we'll talk more in depth about later. And it also led me to become a novelist. So I now write novels that are based on my interview research.
Yeah, we know you are a very important scholar in the field of art-based research, and I do want to make sure that we will talk about it later. But for now, I want to direct our attention to the book. So the book has a very interesting title, Low-Fat Love Stories. Would you like to say more about why or how you came up with this title?
Yes, absolutely. So I originally came up with the concept of low-fat love when I was writing my first novel, which was published years ago. That novel is called Low-Fat Love. And low-fat love, to me, is a concept that really gets at settling in life and love. I think that often people settle in life and love for less than they really want, and they try to pretend what they have is better than it is. So it's sort of like settling for a diet relationship, we might say, and trying to pretend it's the real deal. So when I first wrote my novel, I came up with this idea and I titled that novel Low-Fat Love. And I was absolutely inundated with emails and notes from readers. I was shocked by the response to the novel. It just struck a chord and resonated with people. especially women, but men as well. And I would get very emotional and personal emails and notes from readers telling me their own stories of low fat love and their own stories of settling in life and love. And whenever I would go to do a book event or speak at a conference, people would literally wait in long lines just to whisper their own stories of low fat love to me. And they'd share stories about toxic relationships, partner abuse, eating disorders, depression. There were even stories of attempted suicide. And some readers have even emailed me to tell me that reading the novel Low Fat Love stopped them from committing suicide, which is very, very humbling. And so over the years, hearing these responses to the novel Low Fat Love, I really wanted to honor the stories that all of these people were telling me. So I decided to set out and conduct a new set of interviews that were inspired by people's responses to the novels. So that's why this book is called Low Fat Love Stories, because it's the stories that I gathered that were inspired by what people were telling me after they read the novel.
Yeah, so that's very interesting. And that's like, it also surprised me, like how much we need to talk about those relationships, to talk about those emotions and the feelings. It sounds like, I mean, in our society, there are not that much opportunities to share with people their feelings, their emotions. And this interview, this book, just provides this much needed opportunity for people to share their experience.
Yes, I mean, thank you for that comment. And I think that it's true. I mean, I've learned from the process of doing multiple books, including Low Fat Love Stories, that people really want to share their stories. And just like you suggested, some of the parts of our lives that are really the most important to us, that shape us the most, that are the most emotional, at times that we're the most ashamed about or whatever it might be, all of these different feelings people have, people often have no one with whom to discuss these things. I mean, there are people who I interviewed for Low Fat Love Stories who had not shared these stories with other people in their lives or who had never been given an opportunity to share some of these feelings and emotions and experiences. And so, you know, the idea is absolutely to provide a forum to hear people's stories and then to share those stories with others so that if you have a similar experience, it might resonate with you. Or if you have a very different experience, it might help you learn something about what other people are going through and develop empathy for what other people are going through. But it's very true. There are very few spaces to talk about the things that really matter the most to people. I think it's why something like, you know, Eve Ensler's The Vagina Monologues has been so popular and was so cutting edge initially when it came out, because I think that those people who were interviewed also had never been asked those questions and had never been given a space to talk about those issues. So doing this book was a reminder to me that some of the things that are most important to us and shape our lives the most are things that, ironically, we don't really speak about with other people.
Well, exactly. That's very impressive. Maybe you can give us one or two examples of these kind of stories so that our audience will have a better idea of what are low-fat love stories.
So there are lots of different versions mm-hmm. of low-fat love stories. That concept comes up in people's lives in different ways. But one way that it's come up in many interviews I've done over the years, including a few that are in low-fat love stories, is participating in a toxic relationship. So in other words, you know, there are many women I've interviewed who have participated in relationships that were destructive, where they were in toxic cycles of, it could involve jealousy, feeling insecure in the relationship, wanting to be with the other person more than they want to be with you, or the other person just not being able to give you what it is you really want. And then the cycle of low self-esteem that seems to perpetuate in the women I've interviewed by being in these relationships that are ultimately harmful for one's self-concept and make somebody feel worse about themselves. So that would be a really common example of a low-fat love story. And that's, you know, participating in these toxic relationships And ultimately, I think that to get out of it, it's not just about getting out of an unhealthy relationship, but it's about really looking at yourself and asking yourself some hard questions about why were you settling for less than you wanted? Why were you attracted to someone who was withholding their support or affection? What kept you in a relationship that you were, you know, maybe spinning out of control in or just chronically unhappy in? So those are tough questions we have to ask ourselves. You know, other versions of low-fat love stories might be poor self-image, you know, for example, negative body image and, you know, always yes. comparing yourself to what other people look like or magazines and, you know, the sort of ideal body image that we see splashed across commercial media. And there are these stories of low-fat love where women really struggle every single day looking in the mirror, getting dressed,
yes,
going
exactly.
out into public spaces, you know, putting pictures online, all of that. So that would be another kind of example of a low-fat love story.
So in this sense, the book really facilitates this self-reflection process. It facilitates people asking themselves, why do I want this, for example, toxic relationship? I mean, in this sense, I think the book is therapeutic in many ways.
My hope is that, you know, it would be an empowering process for the women I interviewed. And it's always different for everybody. So you never know, you know, what people will get out of an interview experience and whether or not
right.
it will be transformational for them. But that's optimal. That's the hope, is that it would be an empowering experience and it would give people a chance to reflect on their experiences, maybe in a way they hadn't done before, and really look inward. And I do know that that was the case for not all of the people I interviewed, but for many of the women I interviewed, they did find it to be empowering and in some cases transformational.
Exactly. So I want to just probe a little bit deeper about the perspective of women. So why do you choose this specific perspective? And I think you only include women in the low-fat love stories. Have you included stories about men? Why this gender perspective is so important for you?
It's a great question. I mean, you're right that low-fat love stories only includes women's stories. And that was a choice I made for a few reasons. One of the reasons, obviously, is because I am a woman. I feel like there are things in women's stories that I might be able to relate to in a way that would be more challenging with men. And I have interviewed men over the years, but for this kind of project, I felt like it was important to interview women. I also look at low-fat love in the context of commercial culture. So everything from the body image ideals we were talking about that are in magazines and other forms of media, but also the relationship ideals that we see throughout the culture in television and in film and magazines and novels and all of that. We see these relationship ideals that don't really reflect the relationships a lot of people are actually in. And if people are using that sort of Cinderella fairy tale story as a benchmark for how love should look and how love should feel, it might not work out well in everybody's individual life. So I think that a lot of this commercial culture tells very specific stories about relationships to women, and also how important relationships should be. I mean, there is lots of data about relationships on television comparing men and women, as well as in film and other media. And what you see over and over again is that female characters are often defined based on their relationships to other people, whereas male characters don't have that as the case as often. They are more often defined by their profession or their hobby or their athleticism or something else, whereas women are often defined based on their relationships and their romantic relationship status. And so I think that women in many ways live in a different culture than men live in, and that produces different experiences. And so I really wanted to get at some of those unique experiences that women have, partly as a reflection of the culture that we live in.
Right. So I'm so glad you brought up this topic about culture. And do you consider your book as a type of cultural critique?
I do. I mean,
yeah.
I also look at it as an alternative. I think mm-hmm. that when you take, because the book isn't just stories. I mean, as you know, obviously, there's visual images throughout the book as well. There are representations of the women that were interviewed. And I think that when you look at those representations of women, they are very different than the representations we see in commercial culture. So in that way, my co-author and I really wanted to provide an alternative to the kinds of images and narratives that circulate in the culture.
Wonderful, wonderful. I mean, I indeed can feel a lot of commonalities when you wrote about unique women experience, like all of this relationship, like toxic relationship, this dissatisfying feeling. A lot of the feelings and emotions were perpetuated by this normalized body image, normalized romantic relationship. So I think this is really a good way for us to reflect upon how the dominant culture influence our like self-perception, influence our understanding of ourselves, and how ourselves, like our identity, is constructed by our through out of this cultural, popular cultural themes. So I really feel that aspect of the book is very enlightening for me.
Thank you so much. I mean, I really appreciate that comment because, you know, first and foremost, I am a sociologist. And so I am always thinking about how our environments shape us. And I think that, you know, each of us individually often has this sense that our experiences are so personal and our identities are so personal that means that they, you know, are unto us alone. But the reality is that we are all shaped by the environments that we live in. Now, that doesn't mean that if you consume certain popular culture and I consume it, that it will necessarily impact each of us the same way. But it will impact each of us, and it will impact some of us in very profound ways. So I think it's really important to look at that. And from my perspective as a feminist sociologist, I am looking at it with a critical eye. And I'm asking myself, you know, how, if at all, are these cultural influences harmful? Because I don't think that we have some of the stories of negative body image, for example, and really self-hatred that comes through in some of the stories if we didn't have this ideal that females were supposed to aspire to, that we're told we're supposed to aspire to over and over and over again.
Yes, exactly. I really appreciate that you can adopt this critical eye or this critical perspective. And I think as a reader myself, when I read this book, I really benefited a lot from this critical perspective. And now I want to shift a little bit of our conversation and focus more on like how you produce this book. I mean, the book is an art-based research project, and it's very interesting because it is produced in a way not very typical how say academic book is produced. So it is the book constitutes fictions, stories, and portraits, but those stories and portraits are based on or inspired by your interviews. So maybe I wonder if we can, if you can just briefly talk about what is art-based research and how you conduct art-based research.
Absolutely. So arts-based research is when researchers in any discipline adapt the tenets of the creative arts in their research project. So you are conducting a research study, a research project, but you are drawing on one or more art forms in that process. And you might be using an art form during data collection, during analysis, or during representation, or during all of those phases. And there are researchers in the social sciences, in health, in the natural sciences, in education, I mean, across the disciplines who engage with arts-based research. Sometimes people use arts-based research just at the representation stage so that they have an alternative way of sharing their research findings and perhaps reaching broader public audiences. And you can do arts-based research with any artistic genre. So it could be fiction, visual art, performance-based, and dance, music, theater, a mixed medium like graphic novels or comic books, and many other forms, any art form that you can think about. And in terms of how you do arts-based research, you know, it really does depend on what your goals are and what your particular project is. For people who are interested in learning more about it, I recommend my book, Method Meets Art, which is now in its second edition. Method Meets Art is really a comprehensive introductory guide to arts-based research. Everything from the background to how you do it in the different genres, how you design a project, to evaluation and how you evaluate this form of research. So that's sort of in general sense about arts-based research.
So, you know, we have this very conventional or traditional binary of science and arts. And I'm saying this does not necessarily mean or indicate I agree with this binary, but I want to know your insights about this binary, because in many times we will call the social research we have done, we call it social science. I mean, how science and arts gets blurred or mixed together in art-based research. I wonder if you have any insights to comment on that.
Well, you know, I mean, art and science are seen as very disparate, as you said, as a binary. But in reality, they both have similar goals, or often have similar goals, and that is to illuminate something about human experience or the social world or the natural world. So both art and science exist to expand our understanding and thinking about whatever it is, the topic that the art or the science is addressing. So to me, you know, they're both tools for illuminating something about human experience. And I think that we should use as many tools as we can in order to best address our particular research problems. So, I always compare it to if you just bought a house or a condo and you went to your local hardware store and you needed to buy tools for your house. Now, let's say you decide you're only going to buy a hammer and you go home only with a hammer. Well, every once in a while, that hammer will serve you well. But if your toilet breaks, that hammer's not going to help you. Maybe you also need a wrench. Maybe you need something else. And that's how I look about different disciplines and the methodological tools that the different disciplines provide, that they really are just tools and perspectives that are aiming to get at something larger. And so in my toolkit, you know, I will have tools from the arts. I will have tools from the humanities. I will have tools from the social sciences. And then when I'm working on a project, I will utilize the tools that can best help facilitate my goals. So that's really how I think about it. And I think that in part, you know, the disciplines were created as a way of structuring our professional lives. That doesn't mean that these things aren't actually connected and interconnected in the real world. How we structure the academy in order to organize our professional lives and our careers doesn't necessarily reflect the real world, in which I think these things are much more integrated.
Exactly. And I really appreciate how you use metaphor to make all of these concepts more accessible for us.
And thank you.
Sure. So I wonder if you could say a little bit more about how you choose your art forms and your co-author, Victoria Scorti, how she chose her art form in representing the stories in the Low-Fat Love Stories book. I mean,
Absolutely. I mean, originally, I conducted these interviews, and I was intending to write a traditional nonfiction book like the kind you would typically see academics write. And that was initially my thought. And every time I went to work on the project, I found myself staring at a blank computer screen. I just had the worst writer's block. And I've never really had writer's block. I mean, I'm a pretty prolific author. I've published, 25 books. So I love writing. So it's very unusual for me to be staring at a blank screen. But I kept staring at a blank screen. And at some point, I was having a Skype with Victoria Scotti, who is a creative arts therapist and a visual artist. And we were talking about a totally different project that she was working on. And I was a mentor to her at the time. And I thought, she's conducted interviews with women as well for her own projects. I'm going to tell her about the interviews I've conducted and this low-fat love stories idea and the fact that I'm stuck and just see what she says. So I told her about the project and she said, why don't you send me a summary of one of the interviews? So I did. At that point, I had analyzed all of the interviews in a traditional qualitative way, and I had created summaries for each interview that were about 2 pages, single-spaced each, that had demographic information, the main themes of the interview, and then key quotes from throughout the interview. So I sent Victoria one of these summaries, and she emailed me back and said, when I read this summary, I see a visual image. And I thought that was fascinating because I'm not a visual artist and I don't think the way she thinks. So she and I, emailed back and forth. We had another Skype and we came up with the idea for how we would approach this book. So what we did was I would send her a summary of each interview and then she would create what she called the visual concept, which was a visual representation of the major themes in the interview. She would then send me the visual concept and I would put it in front of me at my desk and I would get the interview transcript from that interview up on my computer and I would begin writing a short story, all told in the first person, as if the woman is telling it herself. And I would use the visual image for inspiration and a starting point of where to begin the story. And I would draw on direct language from the interview transcripts. And how much direct language I used varied from story to story, anywhere from 20% of their exact words all the way up to 80% their exact words. Most of the stories are about 50% their exact words and the rest are my words. But in all cases, the stories 100% reflect their interview transcripts and the themes in them. I just didn't necessarily use their exact language for the whole thing. Then after I would write the story, I would send it to Victoria and she would create what she called the final portrait. And that would be a portrait of the woman. But it had nothing to do with what the woman looks like in real life. Neither she or I had ever met the women, because all of the interviews were done by email. So the visual portrait she created was based on the story I wrote and the major themes to come out of the story. And so that's what the book ended up to be. In the book, every chapter, you have the woman's name and some demographic information like her age and race and sexual orientation. And then you have the visual concept followed by the short story in first person. And it concludes with the final portrait. And that was our approach to this book.
That's a very interesting collaborative process.
Mm.
We have, like, as a researcher myself, I also have conducted collaborative research. I also collaborated with people. More in the sense of we collaborated together, collecting data, interpreting data, but use the same way, trying to code the data, coming up with the major themes, and then we triangulate our peer debrief and member check. I mean, here you and, like, from what you described just now, it seems that you and Victoria have a very different but also very smooth and productive way of producing this book.
Yes, it's very different from the process that you described, which is something I'm very familiar with. I mean, I was trained as a qualitative researcher and a methodologist, But we came up with this approach, you know, and in the beginning, when we came up with this approach, we decided we'd do it for one or two of the women and then make a decision of whether or not it worked. And by work, we mean really get at the essence of these women's stories. I mean, that's what we wanted to do, is find a way to most authentically share these women's stories. And after we did the first couple of stories, we both felt very strongly that we were really communicating these women's stories in a powerful way that people could read in the academy, but anybody could read. Women like the women that we had interviewed could read this book and enjoy the art and really take something away from it. So it was a very different creative research process. But like we talked about before, this is arts-based research. I mean, this is only one example of it, but this is an example where I began with qualitative interviews, which is a very traditional method, and then we went to an arts-based approach for the analysis, the interpretation, and the final representation. And I have to say, reading the book now, I really do feel like it truly represents these interviews in a way that a traditional approach would not have been able to do, with the same emotion and power, and to be engaging in a way that anybody could pick it up and really read it. So it is a very different process and very collaborative. And what was also interesting collaborating with Victoria for this project is that neither of us really had expertise with what the other person was doing, which I've never had a collaboration like that before. You know, I had written novels prior to writing this, so this was not my first time writing fiction. And Victoria is not a writer of fiction. So that's not something she does. And by the same token, she's a talented and accomplished visual artist, and I can't even draw a stick figure that looks convincing. So neither of us really had the skill set the other person had, which created a lot of trust between us, because I really had to trust her and let her go with the techniques she thought were best to use and the vision she had for how to do the visual art. And I think she felt she had to do the same for me with writing the stories. And we did give each other feedback. So I gave her feedback on the art, what I liked, what I thought was powerful, things that I weren't sure if they worked as well. And she did the same thing. She gave me feedback on all of the stories. But we also really had to trust each other, because each of us brought something very different to the table.
So why do you think the trust part is so important? I mean, usually we will talk about we need to build our trust. I mean, we need to trust our research participants. And also, we need to conduct our interview, our qualitative studies in a way that will allow our research participants to trust us. But here, I'm hearing you say it's very important for the collaborators to trust each other, and for the art forms, like for different art forms, to trust each other. So I want to ask why you think this trust its feature is so important here.
It's a great question, because we do often think about trust with our research participants, which of course is so important and was important in this book, but we don't often talk about trust between researchers when there's a collaboration. And these days, when you look at the research world, in many fields, the majority of articles that are written are co-authored. They're not single authored. So people are working in research teams more and more, and research is becoming more and more collaborative. And so I think it's really important to talk about what makes for the best collaborations. And I can't speak to, you know, every field and every kind of project that one might engage in, but I can say for this project and in an arts-based research project, I think trust is absolutely vital, because, you know, the reason it's important is because if somebody is doing something that you yourself are not capable of doing, you really need to put your faith in them and support them so they can do that. And that's what Victoria and I did for each other. I mean, she could have created these visual concepts and these portraits in many different ways. She could have used different mediums. She could have used different approaches. I mean, she's somebody who's able to draw or paint anything she pleases. So she made many choices about the materials, the approach, the style, and how she was going to do this. And I had to trust that, because I am not an expert in visual art. She is. I'm not. I had to trust that. And I think she had to do the same with my writing the stories. And also, when you're creating art, you do really put a lot of yourself into it, and you are very vulnerable. I've written both fiction and nonfiction, and I can say that in my personal experience, I feel much more vulnerable when I'm writing fiction. There's something about sharing creative artistic work. And so I think if you're going to do that in a collaborative setting, the other person really needs to respect that you are putting yourself out there as an artist, and they need to support that. Now, that doesn't mean they can't make suggestions or comments if they see something that they think should be worked on. And we certainly did that for each other. But the overarching feeling we both had was of support for one another. And I have to say that, you know, this is my favorite collaboration I've ever worked on. I've co-authored and co-edited over the years. You know, I've worked with various colleagues and friends. But this was a really unique and special collaboration because we weren't just sort of dividing up the work per se, but we were each doing something different. And the sum of the parts was bigger. You know, the sum total was bigger than the parts themselves. So neither Victoria nor I could have done this book alone. And I think we both knew that. And so we were really committed to telling these women's stories in the best possible way. And to make that happen, we had to rely on each other. And that requires a great deal of trust.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And totally. I really appreciate how you brought up these components of being able to show your vulnerable part in this process. And I think that's very important. And that's very unique in this project. And probably also that is why this project just influenced so many people, and so many readers share the same, like, resonant with the book.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I have found it with all of the novels I've written, as well as these low-fat love stories, that you do make yourself very vulnerable, but then when you hear the way readers respond, they also make themselves vulnerable. They make themselves vulnerable when they read these books, when they open themselves up to these emotions, when they use them to reflect on their own lives. And then if they decide to share with you as an author their experience, they're also making themselves very vulnerable. And so I really honor that experience, and I really treasure that people do that, and I don't take it for granted. So it's you know, I feel an experience of gratitude that readers also make themselves vulnerable. And, you know, my first novel, Low-Fat Love, which ultimately inspired Low-Fat Love Stories, but that first novel, Low-Fat Love, is very raw. And for some readers who could relate to it, it was not necessarily an easy read. And I really appreciate that they were willing to make themselves vulnerable in order to read it and in order to make it a part of maybe how they were thinking about themselves and their own choices in their own life.
Yeah, and I also want to say that this part of all this feature of vulnerability is part of this process of becoming more strong, becoming stronger, I mean.
Yes.
Yes, and I really appreciate here you can dive deeper into the collaborative process and share with us your experience with doing art-based research. And I just want to zoom in a little bit closer to the interviews. So
sure.
You mentioned you conduct the interview via emails. Would you like to share some thoughts behind this decision? I mean, why do you choose interviews through emails instead of, I mean, there are many other ways to conduct the interview, surely.
Absolutely. And this is the only time that I've done email interviews specifically for low-fat love stories. And I have to say, if I ever had a project for which it would be appropriate again, I would absolutely do it because it works so well for low-fat love stories. When I decided I wanted to take what people were telling me about my novel, Low-Fat Love, and I wanted to honor it by doing a new project, I decided that it was very important that it would reflect many different kinds of women, because it was many different kinds of women, women from different backgrounds, women with different experiences, who had read the novel Love That Love and who had approached me or emailed me about it. And so I felt like that diversity needed to be honored in the next project as well. And so I really wanted to interview women from across the United States. I wanted people who live in different kinds of communities. I wanted people who live in cities, people who live in rural areas, people who live in places that are, you know, very liberal, and people who live in places that are very conservative. I wanted people from different economic backgrounds. And of course, the hope was to get people from different racial and ethnic backgrounds, different religious backgrounds, different gender identities or sexual orientation. And so, you know, there were limitations. At the end of the day, I could only interview the people who responded. And so you don't always get the full range of diversity that you're hoping for. And that was certainly the case with this book. But I was able to get a much bigger cross-section of women than I would have been able to get doing, you know, in-person interviews, for example, which is what I had always done in the past. But when I had interviewed people in the past, they had always been much more similar to each other because they were bound by geography as well as other factors. So it was really important to me to get women across the country and also to get women at different age ranges, you know, anywhere from 18 through their 70s or 80s, because I think that we have different experiences and different wisdom and different ways of reflecting back at different points in our lives. And so I wanted to reflect women of all ages. And I primarily wanted to reflect older women's stories, because so often our culture just shares the stories of young women. We see women in their teens and 20s, and their stories are constantly populating the culture. But what about women in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s? We don't often see those women's stories. So all of that was important to me. And so I decided that the only way it would be feasible to do these interviews was to do them by email. So I did have initial contact emails with people, talking to them about the project, talking about, you know, my goals for the project, how it might be published and all of that. And when people chose to participate, of course, they had to sign informed consent and we had to go through that process. And then I would email them the interviews and I gave everybody a choice. They could have an interview that focused on a dissatisfying relationship and they could pick a romantic relationship, a family member, or it could be another relationship, such as a friend or coworker. Although I think just about everyone chose a romantic relationship or a family member. Or they could choose to do a relationship, an interview about their relationship with their own body. So a body image interview. So they picked the interview they wanted, and I sent them the interview guide. And I asked them to return it in a certain amount of time, but I always extended more time for anybody who needed it. And then when I would receive them back, I would email them. And sometimes there would be a few emails back and forth for clarification, or the women would want to know something. They'd have follow-up questions. And so I really felt like I was able to get the data I was after. And, you know, it's also interesting because by doing it by email, I didn't think of this in advance, if I'm honest with you, but I realized it after the fact that people tell their stories very differently if they are writing them versus if they're sitting in a room with you or over the phone or on Skype, telling you in some way that's in the moment and in person. If people are writing their interviews, they can think about it. They can do it over an extended amount of time. I mean, some women took, you know, a couple of months to write their interviews. They don't have to do it all in one sitting. They can go back and edit and clarify if they want to. But it also really prompts reflection. Because the women have so much time to think about and to do the interviews, they can really reflect on their experiences and reflect on what they want to say and how they want to say it. Oftentimes in an interview, people might give you the information they want to give you if it's an in-person interview, but they don't necessarily word things the way they want to. But this allows people that time to really think about their own experience, to do it in a private setting if they want. These are very emotional stories the women shared. I know that many of them appreciated having an opportunity to do it in a private setting on their own and to really reflect on their stories. And I think, you know, a lot of the women told me that just when they submitted the interviews, that the experience of writing their stories was very cathartic and really made them reflect on things. In some cases, things they had thought in depth about for years, but yet the act of writing it still made them think about it in a new and deeper way. And so I thought that was fantastic.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing with us all these details about the interview process. And I hear you about how thoughtful it could be for a woman to write down her experience. And that process may take even longer than we expect, like we expected.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, one thing I found about the book is that the book is actually very versatile. It could be read by the academics, it could be read by the general intellectual audience, and it could also be used in all different forms of classes. Do you want to would you like to talk a little bit more about how to use the book, different ways of use the book?
Absolutely, and I really appreciate those comments, so thank you so much. When Victoria and I wrote this, we made a decision, a conscious decision, that we wanted it to have a public readership, you know, assuming people want to read it, but we wanted women who are like the women we interviewed to have the ability to read it on their own, on a beach, on an airplane, in a book club, but we also wanted it to be an academic text. And that was really important to us. We really felt like this is an academic text that could be used in a variety of classes. So, for example, in courses about popular culture and media culture, in courses about gender and women's studies. So, you know, introduction to gender studies, sociology of gender, those kinds of classes. In psychology courses, including the psychology of women, in relational communication courses, in social work courses, some of the dynamics in these relationships, some of which are abusive family relationships and romantic relationships, could really provide food for thought in social work courses. So it was really important to us that it could be used in all of these academic classes. And as a result, we included a robust introduction to the book where we talk about popular culture. We provide statistics about popular culture. And all of these topics I'm talking about, we touch on in this academic introduction. And there are also appendixes where we share our interview protocol in depth, much more so than even we could talk about here during this podcast. And we also provide activities for classroom use. So discussion questions, research activities, artistic activities that you can literally do right inside of the book. So, you know, our hope is that professors will consider adopting the book for their courses because the stories are so powerful. And I believe that the visual art is also so powerful that I think it's a wonderful way to use these women's stories as a springboard for reflection on a range of topics that you might talk about in sociology, gender studies, or communication course. And then, of course, it could also be used in a qualitative methods course or a related sort of research methods course on narrative inquiry or arts-based research or even creative writing. And toward that end, we also included the interview guides at the end of the book. So we have a detailed discussion about our methodology in the appendix, and then we have reprinted all of the interview guides so that people can use those same guides themselves, or they can use them as models and adapt them to their own studies. So our hope is that women outside of the academy will read the book just for their own experience and as a way of reflecting on their own lives, and that professors will consider integrating it into their courses. You know, I found with my novels, which have been well adopted in courses across the curriculum, I found that students typically really enjoy having the fictional format and the characters to talk about, as opposed to quote-unquote real people, because it's engaging to them, it's fun for them to read, but it also really provides food for thought in a way that feels safe. You know, they're not talking about their own lives or their friends. They're not talking about a study that's presented as a bunch of statistics. but they have these characters that they've grown to have feelings about that they can talk about. And I think it's even more powerful with low-fat love stories in the sense that these individual women's stories are each really powerful. Some of them are tough and tough to read. They were tough to read when I was reading the initial interview transcripts because they touch on some pretty dark things. And some of the women have experienced a lot of unhappiness and some still are. But I think it really provides a great springboard for discussion.
Well, thank you. As a person who also teach qualitative research, who also teach educational studies, I can definitely see how these stories and the activities could be adapted into a methodology course, for example. And I really appreciate that you can include all of those components in addition to the stories into this book.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we have taken so much time from you today, Patricia. Before we wrap up our conversation, would you like to say a little bit more about your current project?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I mean, this has been a great discussion, and I really appreciate all of your comments about the book. So right now I have a couple of things going on. I recently released a book that you might be interested in called The Handbook of Arts-Based Research. So for people who are interested in arts-based research, The Handbook of Arts-Based Research is really the most comprehensive book out there. I asked leading scholars, leading artists who work at the cutting edge of arts-based research, and they all generously wrote amazing chapters. The book is just filled with visual art, music, performance scripts, but also lots of background, lots of how-to information, lots of research design information. So for people interested in arts-based research, I hope they'll check it out. And as for what's coming next, this August I have a co-authored book coming out called Contemporary Feminist Research from Theory to Practice. And that's coming out with Guilford Press, and my co-author's name is Anne Harris, and we're both very excited to have that book released. It's actually already available on Amazon and at the Guilford website for pre-order. And as for what I'm, you know, working on my desk right now, I am writing another novel. I'm always working on a new novel. I mean, I actually have a novel that's already done that's coming out in March. That's also with Guilford Press. And I'm not allowed to talk about that yet, the novel that's coming out in March, because we want it to be a surprise. But I will say that for people interested in the research process, I think they'll be very interested in this novel. But I'm also working on another one. So that's keeping me busy. I'm in a little creative writing spurt right now.
Well, I'm pretty sure it sounds like your plate is very full for me. I mean, all the book projects sound very interesting, and we really look forward to having you again in our new book series. And thank you so much for joining us today, Patricia. The book is very interesting and very inspiring to talk about, and it's just a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your support and all of your wonderful questions and kind comments, and I would love to be a guest again. So thank you again for having me.
Sure. Hope to see you again soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.